Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may have noticed that Elon Musk has a weakness, a fondness for the letter X. He's renamed Twitter X. He named the four-year-old son he brandished in the Oval Office this week X, and a number of other letters following that are even harder to figure out. So he's, he's a serious guy. He's a businessman. He's 53 years old, old enough to, know something. And certainly he's taken on a very serious task in putting a lot of people who used to work in the federal government out of work, out of their jobs. There may be other consequences to education and health care yet to be formally defined. But he also has another side. This week, according to The Economist, he changed his X account name to Harry B-O-L-Z. Second time he's adopted this alias. In case you're wondering how that's pronounced, here's Dana Bash of CNN to help you.
Now, the disruptor in chief, Elon Musk, who apparently has adopted the alias, at least he changed his social media handle to Harry Balls.
After which Musk tweeted, quote, "Made them say my name," unquote. He's 53. The Economist says he briefly changed his username to that a couple years ago. And at the time he said, quote, "To be honest, I'm just hoping a media org that takes itself way too seriously writes a story about Harry Balls," unquote. After he changed his name, according to The Economist, the cryptocurrency named Harry Balls experienced an immediate and dramatic price surge. Crypto traders bought the token, similar to past incidents with meme coins like Dogecoin, also based on something Elon Musk once said. Market analyst says the economists are monitoring the situation. So maybe the whole taking over the federal government thing is just a cover for a cryptocurrency scam. The Economist explains, many of Musk's social media antics seem intended to amuse both himself and his audience. He frequently taps into online trends and memes. He's 53, ladies and gentlemen. Quote, "By generating discussions around his name changes, Musk keeps attention on his X profile," unquote. So maybe what we're living through is just the battle of the attention hogs. Hello, welcome to the show.
Well, I've been to Paris, I've lived in L.A., I've been down to Mexico and on the road to Mandalay. I've seen the seven wonders of the world, but there ain't nothing like the Mardi Gras. I'm gonna get in my car tomorrow, I'm gonna drive 3 days and nights, I'm gonna drive through sleet and snow until I see them. With a smile on my face, wild, wild heart.
From the aforementioned New Orleans, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Yeah, we got the Super Bowl people out of here, and it's Mardi Gras time. The only way you can tell the difference is one of them is filled with ads, and the other one has no ads at all. Take your pick, and now...
Looks like Must Club.
And he's 53, and he's still... Over the last 4 years, Tesla has sued at least six car owners in China who had sudden vehicle malfunctions, quality complaints, or accidents they claimed were caused by mechanical failures. The company has also sued at least six bloggers and two Chinese media outlets that wrote critically about the company. According to a review of public court documents and Chinese media reports by the Associated Press, we don't like them anymore, do we? Tesla won all 11 cases for which AP could determine the verdicts. Two judgments are on appeal. One case was settled out of court. It's not common practice for automakers in China or elsewhere to sue their customers, but Tesla has pioneered an aggressive legal strategy and leveraged the patronage of powerful leaders in China's ruling Communist Party to silence critics, reap financial rewards, and limit its accountability. And he's working for this government. Isn't that wild? And he's 53. Oh, Grimes has spoken out. Remember her? She was his one-time girlfriend. She spoke out after Musk paraded their four-year-old son, X, around the Oval Office this week. She shares three children with him. He's the father now of 13. That's lucky. She took to X to respond to her son's surprise appearance, saying, quote, "He should not be in public like this. I did not see this. Thanks for alerting me, but I'm glad he was polite. Sigh," unquote. Her comment came in response to another user who claimed that little X was so very polite today. Grimes has remained outspoken on X, responding to fans and spouting her political views, as well as denouncing her ex's alleged ties to the alt-right and Nazism. One user attacked her on X last month for not intervening with Musk's habit of parading their son in the public eye. Quote, "I've made it clear I do not approve of that in any in every conceivable way. I know I am. I am desperate to solve it. It is a personal tragedy to me, but currently I don't know how to do that," unquote. Would take an engineer or something to solve that problem. And in related matters of AI.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip, hip, hooray.
Hip, hip, hooray. Representative from Elon Musk's Doge service. It's a service. It's a Doge. Have fed sensitive data from across the education department into artificial intelligence software that is to probe the agency's programs and spending. This according to people with knowledge of the Doge team's activities. They're playing Dogeball. The AI probe includes data with personally identifiable information for people who manage grants, as well as sensitive internal financial data. The two sources said they described Doge activities at the Education Department on the condition of anonymity. The team is using AI software accessed through Microsoft's cloud computing service Azure Leave, to pore over every dollar of money the department disburses, from contracts to grants to work trip expenses. Lower-level department staffers were directed by agency leadership to let Musk's teams access the sensitive financial data. The use of AI inside the education department hasn't been previously reported, but it shows how Musk's Department of Governmental Efficiency is tapping the favorite tool of Silicon Valley as part of its mission to drastically slash the size and functions of the federal government. So, And this is going to happen in other departments too. Government employees, watch your Social Security numbers. Still smarting from Apple intelligence, butchering a headline, the BBC has published research into how accurately AI assistants summarize the news. The results don't make for happy reading, according to the British tech journal, The Register. In January, Apple's AI service, which is now on your phone, unless you don't let it be, generated a headline of a BBC news story that appeared on iPhones, claiming that Luigi Mangione, the man arrested over the murder of the healthcare insurance CEO, had shot himself. This wasn't true. And the public broadcaster complained to Apple, which first promised software changes to, quote, further clarify when the displayed content is a summary provided by Apple Intelligence, then later temporarily disabled news and entertainment summaries. It's still not active. As of the latest update of iOS 18, Apple Intelligence is far from the only generative AI service capable of news summaries. The episode has given the BBC pause for thought. Program Director for Generative AI, Peter Archer, wrote about the corporation's enthusiasm for the technology, detailing some of the ways in which the BBC had implemented it internally, generating subtitles, translating articles. Quote, AI will bring real value when it's used responsibly, he said. The research focused on OpenAI's ChatGPT, Microsoft's Copilot, Google's Gemini, and Perplexity. All of these are AI assistants. They assessed their ability to provide accurate responses to questions about the news. The assistants were granted access to the BBC for the duration of the test. Responses were reviewed by BBC journalists, all experts in the question topics. 51% of all AI answers to questions about the news were judged to have significant issues of some form. 19% of AI answers which cited BBC content introduced factual errors, incorrect factual statements, numbers, and dates. 13% of the quotes sourced from BBC were either altered from the original source or not present in the article cited. BBC News and Current Affairs CEO Deborah Ternis wrote, quote, it's not hard to see how quickly AI's distortion could undermine people's already fragile faith in facts and verified information. We live in troubled times. How long will it be before an AI-distorted headline causes significant real-world harm? The companies developing Gen AI tools are playing with fire, unquote. But wait, AI not only hurts the reader, it also may hurt the user. A new paper from researchers at Microsoft and Carnegie Mellon University finds that as humans increasingly rely on AI in their work, they use less critical thinking, which can, quote, result in the deterioration of cognitive faculties that ought to be preserved. The researchers continue, a key irony of automation, yes, there's irony in automation, is that by mechanizing routine tasks and leaving exception handling to the human user, you deprive the user of the routine opportunities to practice their judgment and strengthen their cognitive musculature, leaving them atrophied and unprepared when the exceptions do arise. Unquote. Researchers also found that users with access to Gen AI tools produce a less diverse set of outcomes for the same task compared to those without. This tendency for convergence reflects a lack of personal, contextualized, critical, and reflective judgment of AI output, and thus can be interpreted as a deterioration of critical thinking, unquote. Or it could just be interpreted as noise. Speaking of noise, early in today's program, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
And an AI-motivated apology, demonstrating yet again that uncritically trusting the output of generative AI is dangerous. Attorneys involved in a product liability lawsuit have apologized to the presiding judge for submitting documents that cite non-existing legal cases. The lawsuit began with a complaint filed June 2023 against Walmart and Jetson Electric Bikes over a fire allegedly caused by a hoverboard. The blaze destroyed the plaintiff's house, causing serious burns to family members. Last week, Wyoming District Judge Kelly Rankin issued an order to show cause that directs the plaintiff's attorneys to explain why they should not be sanctioned, because they cited eight cases that do not exist. The citations were made as part of an argument the lawyers hoped would mean some evidence could not be presented to the jury. The document cites nine cases in support of its arguments. In a subsequent filing, the case was hallucinated by OpenAI's ChatGPT. It gets worse. Another of the imagined proceedings dredged up by the AI is real, but known by a different name, under a different judge. As noted by the judge in this case, eight of the nine citations were pulled from thin air or led to cases with different names, pointing to some of the past instances where AI chatbots have hallucinated in legal proceedings over the past few years. The judge's order asked the attorneys who signed the filing to explain why they should not be punished. Two of the attorneys responded, our internal artificial intelligence platform hallucinated the cases in question while assisting our attorney in drafting the motion in limine. This serves as a cautionary tale for our firm and all firms as we enter this new age of artificial intelligence. The third attorney involved shouldered the blame. Quote, with a repentant heart, I sincerely apologize to this court, to my firm and colleagues representing defendants for this mistake and any embarrassment I may have caused. The last week has been very humbling for me professionally and personally, one that I can guarantee shall not ever repeat itself. Unquote. Repeating, repeat itself. Dateline Seattle Pike Place Market Foundation apologized this week for pulling support from a remembrance event honoring Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II. The market decided not to move forward with the Day of Remembrance event hosted by the Tsuru for Solidarity Network after the event explicitly tied Japanese incarceration during the Second World War to the current Trump administration immigration crackdown. Said the Market Foundation, we acknowledge our decision around Day of Remembrance and Resistance created direct harm and impacted our entire community. They offered an apology, committing to support Japanese Americans who are a notable part of Seattle history and the development of the market itself. This was in the market, sir. Amazon is trying to clear the air after Mandy Moore said the company delivered a package to her in-laws' home, which, apparently unknown to Amazon, was destroyed in the L.A. wildfires. Amazon has since apologized to the actress and is trying to figure out what happened.
Hey, what happened?
There's the guy from Amazon right now. Jack Schlossberg, grandson of JFK, caused quite a stir after he scrubbed his social media presence and left a puzzling, now-vanished message that sparked worry among his followers. Quote, this one goes out to Usha Vance, the most beautiful woman in the world, he recently announced to his half-million TikTok followers, referencing J.D. Vance's wife. The only son of Caroline Kennedy has deactivated both his ex and Instagram accounts, writing, quote, I'm sorry to everyone I hurt. I was wrong. I'm deleting all my social media. Forever. It's been fun. Thanks anyways, everyone. Unquote. He was outspoken in his backing for former President Biden, firmly resisted the political pursuits of the current president and most notably his uncle, RFK Jr. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast leading directly to News of the Godly. The contents of a former Catholic bishop's home in Newry, England, have been auctioned by the Diocese of Dromore. This is Northern Ireland, actually, which will use some of the proceeds to compensate clerical abuse victims. In recent years, the diocese was sued by a number of people who were sexually abused as children by Dromore clergymen, including the late Father Malachy Finnegan. The bishop's house was earmarked in 2023 as being among the diocesan assets that could be sold to meet its liabilities. In a statement, the diocese said it was also selling the contents of the house to fund various safeguarding matters, including redress for victims and survivors of abuse. Finnegan, who died in 2002, was headmaster of the neighboring boys' school, also served as a parish priest. Some of his victims received six-figure sums in compensation after initiating legal action against the diocese. A few months after that settlement, the diocese identified assets it could sell in order to meet our existing and ongoing safeguarding responsibilities. This week, hundreds of items from inside the listed building, including ornate furniture, paintings, and ornaments, went under the hammer. Just like the boys. No, please. The Jesuit Order in Ireland has named a further 15 deceased Jesuits who've been the subject of child sexual abuse complaints, eight of whom were already the subject of complaint during their lifetimes. The other seven first became the subject of complaint after their deaths. All allegations in these cases have been reported to police and statutory authorities. It follows an examination of files of deceased Jesuits by an independent working group, which was established by the Jesuits in Ireland way last year. It was convened following the publication of accounts concerning child sexual abuse and other serious misconduct by Father Joseph Marmion in 2021, and further reports relating to Father Paul Andrews and Father Dermot Casey, which were published last year. The order found that the publication and the identification of one or more perpetrators had the effect of bringing forward evidence in relation to other perpetrators. The order has acknowledged and apologized for failings. And Pope Francis this week accepted the resignation of an influential Peruvian bishop who's come under criticism for not doing enough to stop, say it with me now, abuses committed by a conservative Catholic movement that was recently disbanded by the Vatican. Peru's bishops' conference said Archbishop Miguel Cabrejos will be replaced by the Jesuit Bishop Gilberto Vizcarra. The reason for the Pope's decision was not provided. Embarrassment? You be the judge. News of the godly. And finally, in this smart, smart, smart world, Google Maps has blocked reviews for the Gulf of Mexico. This comes after criticism of its decision to relabel it the Gulf of America only for its users in the United States. People in Mexico will still see Gulf of Mexico. Users elsewhere will see both names appear on maps. Both Apple and Microsoft's Bing have also kissed the ring. I made the switch to Gulf of America. Clicking on the label for the Gulf in Google Maps now brings up a note saying, posting is currently turned off. Meaning, don't leave your angry messages here. Google appears to have deleted some negative reviews left in the wake of its name change. The company has defended its decision, saying it regularly puts protections on places during times when we anticipate an uptick of contributions that are off topic or unrelated to someone's direct experience with the place. Have you had a direct experience with the Gulf of Mexico? It's nice. It also highlighted a 2023 blog post about how it tackles policy-violating content, such as fake reviews, and when it disables contributions or removes content to prevent abuse of its tools. Users on social media claim hundreds of one-star reviews have been removed, accusing Google of censorship. The most recent review left for the location result on Google Maps appears to be from a month ago. Critics have since taken to posting negative one-star ratings of the Google Maps app itself on Apple's App Store, with several describing the app and its labels as, quote, factually inaccurate. So-called review bombing has become a popular form of online protest against companies or businesses that appear in Google search or Maps results. And This just in, another name change on its way.
Today, I'm signing an executive order renaming the Canada Goose the American Goose, which it should have been ever since we knew about goose.
Back here at the Lashodum, just a moment of news about our friend the Atom. Workers at Japan's crippled Fuk nuclear plant have started dismantling water storage tanks to free up space for tons of nuclear debris. 14 years after the thing, TEPCO, the operator, has been charged with finding a suitable place to store around 880 tons of radioactive material that remains inside the damaged reactors at the plant. Currently, there's no more land available in Fuk province, says the project manager for TEPCO. Three of the plant's six reactors, of course, went bluey. Quote, as long as the fuel debris remains in its current state, the risks remain very high. That's the comment of Nobuhide Sato, a risk specialist at TEPCO. Yes, they have those. Now, clean, cheap, safe to... safe to meter. Our friend the Atom.
You can see that Zulu Queen down on St. Cloud and Domain. See that Zulu Queen down on St. Cloud and Domain. Oh, and if you wait right there now, I'm sure you'll see that Zulu again. That's why I'm going home to New Orleans. I'm going home to New Orleans. Going home to New Orleans. Going home.
This is Le Show, and we have been bombarded with information about certain kinds of inflation recently, most notably the price of eggs, which I think you can buy a chicken for less than the eggs these days. But one element of inflation that seems to have been ignored recently was reported on about 4 or 5 months ago in a newsletter. It's called Big And it's written by Matt Stoller, who is Director of Research for the American Economic Liberties Project. And it's a newsletter that focuses on all sorts of areas in our current economy in which monopolies play a part. Perhaps the most bizarre was when Matt revealed that there was a monopoly forming around cheerleading, but that's a subject for another day. Today, I want to talk with him about rent, residential rent. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we know, I guess, that in the aftermath of the recession in 2008, private equity started buying up homes and apartments, right?
That is correct. Single-family homes, yeah.
And at a certain point, that reached a level where they had putatively pricing power in the market?
Well, so a lot of housing is really complicated. I mean, everything's really complicated, so I'm not trying to... It's always an excuse. It's just a market. It's just an area that has... like a lot of different parts to it, because it's regional, mm-hmm. right? So market power, it's like if you own a bunch of houses or apartments in an area that's really, really big, you may not have pricing power.
Mm-hmm.
But if you own a bunch in an area that's maybe not as big, you could have pricing power. There are also different kinds of homes, higher end, lower end, mm-hmm. and there's ownership, there's renting. Section 8 housing and all the rest of it. So it's just there's a lot of different kind of what you would call submarkets. But there's a number of areas to think about. And when we're talking about rent, right, you're talking largely about a specific type of housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of apartments in urban areas. There is rent all over the place. There's single family homes that are for rent. But the case that I've been focusing on over the last couple of years is something that was revealed by ProPublica a few years ago, and then there have been a series of antitrust cases on it, which is that big corporate landlords that own, 500,000 units across the country, a million units across the country, a substantial number of units in a city like Atlanta or mm-hmm. Austin mm-hmm. or city of D.C. and suburbs, they all use one common software platform, which is called RealPage. And that software platform is largely an inventory management platform. So, you go and you're like, okay, I run a building with 100 units in it. It says, here are the units. Here's who's in them. Like, it's just, a management system. But RealPage also recommends prices. And this is where it gets collusive. Because what they do is if everybody uses RealPage software, and about 90% of the people, big corporate landlords, use it, and they're all sharing their data, then, they're starting to collude. They're starting to look a little bit less like independent landlords, and they're starting to look more like a cartel. And especially if RealPage is making recommendations for them to raise rents, which is what the ProPublica article alleged and what has come out in a bunch of antitrust cases across the country and by the federal government. It's especially bad because RealPage also encourages these landlords to get together and talk to each other about pricing and inventory levels. And so a couple of things are happening. One is rent prices in areas where corporate landlords are using RealPage, they tend to be higher in, among those particular landlords. And it's, those can be a substantial part of the market. So you see, Atlanta, the prices have gone nuts since 2016, which is when RealPage really started to capture a lot of the market. But the other thing that's happened is when you raise rents and people don't rent from you, the incentive is, well, I've got empty apartments. I'm going to lower my rate to try to capture tenants. But you're capturing a tenant from someone else, probably another corporate landlord. That's the essence of competition. That's why we like competition, because mm-hmm. it reduces prices. It forces, rivals to discipline each other. But if you have some coordinating body like RealPage telling them, hey, keep your apartment empty because that will raise prices for everyone. And yeah, you won't be able to fill that apartment, but we'll all make more money in aggregate. Then what happens is you'll have a lot of units that are held off the market. It's an artificial housing shortage. Mm. And so that's what's also going on. And the result of this, and there was a bunch of coverage about this, I don't know, over the last couple of years, the sort of waves of coverage go up and they, you know, go down. So sometimes people are not talking about it like mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. But there are these antitrust suits, and then there are bills, that legislation that have passed in a number of cities that have been introduced in a bunch of states, trying to ban what's called algorithmic rent fixing, which is what's going on. Uh-huh. So in Philadelphia and San Francisco have both banned the practice of using algorithms to set rent prices. And then my organization set up a site called endrentfixing.com where you can see the states where such bills have been introduced. And so you have these cases going on. These cases tend to take a long time, years. They could take years. But then you also have legislation that's happening. So there's attempts to kind of prevent these landlords from colluding with one another. You know, there are other problems in the market. It's not like this is the only thing that's going on. Mm. We do have a housing shortage. We need to build a lot more housing. But the fundamental problem, you know, is that if you do build more housing, but you allow these big landlords to capture it all, then they're going to hold housing off the market to keep prices high. So you have to kind of build more, but you also to reduce prices, but you also have to prevent collusion.
Okay, let me ask a couple of basic questions here to set the ground for what we're talking about. Can you explain what pricing power means in the world of monopolies?
Pricing power just means the ability to raise prices without losing much business, right? So if I'm selling, you know, ice cream on a hot day at the beach and I'm the only person selling ice cream, I can sell ice cream and I'm charging, you know, $4 for a cone of ice cream. I can charge $5 and I will probably have the same number of customers. That's pricing power, right? If there's a bunch of people selling ice cream and I raise my price $5 and then I lose customers because of it, then I don't have pricing power. Mm-hmm. That's in a very simple way, a simple way to explain it.
Right. And, you know, when I was in school, I remember there were two major antitrust acts that had been passed, I guess, in the late 19th century, the Sherman and the Clayton Acts. Are they still in effect today?
They are. So the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1890, and, you know, it keeps getting updated both in Congress and through the courts. And then, you know, the Clayton Act, which came a little bit later, but it has also been updated a number of times. And Congress actually passed a new antitrust law in slight update in 2022. So, you know, and then courts have been hearing these cases, and, you know, that's a way that the law gets refreshed and reused. So, yeah, antitrust law is alive and well, maybe not well, but it's alive. you know, it's coming back.
Well, to judge by your newsletter and the number of areas of the economy in which monopolies take hold, antitrust doesn't seem to be all too healthy as a form of law these days, or am I misreading it?
You are misreading. It's actually great. It's going really well. You know, just to give you a sense of how bad things were, it basically was not enforced starting in the early 80s. There's some cases, you know, there was AT&T case, there was Microsoft case. There was nothing, but it really, in the 2000s, it essentially, like, the Bush administration stopped enforcing monopolization law. There were parts of antitrust law that were still enforced, but, you know, the Obama administration, same thing. From 1998 to 2019, the Department of Justice didn't bring a single monopolization claim. Mm. That is bad, okay? But then in 2020, the Trump administration brought a case against Google, one of the most powerful companies in the world, and another case against Facebook, another one of the most powerful companies in the world. Big deal. Those are two monopolization cases. They're ongoing. The Google case, the Biden administration continued it and won it. So they won it last year. which is a big deal to win a big monopolization case. Mm-hmm. But they also introduced a bunch of other cases. So there are cases, there's an antitrust case, a big monopolization case against Apple. There's one against Amazon. There's one against Ticketmaster. There's there actually is one against RealPage for being a monopoly in this area. There are cases against seeds and chemical companies. There's a case against Pepsi. There's like a ton of cases that are happening in this area and then also adjacent. And Google has not only lost the one against the government, there's also a private case that Google lost against a company called Epic Games. And the one that they lost against the government was for their search monopoly. The one they lost against Epic Games was for their control of app stores. So it's a very healthy area of law, relatively speaking. The Trump administration this time is likely to try to roll back some of the gains that were made under the first Trump administration, the Biden administration. But yeah, there are reasons to be pretty optimistic here. Not necessarily about the world in general.
Right, right.
But about this particular, you know, area of law.
Although a sharp-eyed observer could say that the people who were represented in the front rows of at the inauguration were some of the people who were involved in those lawsuits, and maybe the lawsuits were going to be pursued less aggressively going forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was really clear that, you know, the bags of money dressed up as human beings sitting in the inauguration, you know, it was Jeff Bezos I think Jeff Bezos was there, Mark Zuckerberg.
Tim Cook. Yeah.
Sundar Pichai, who's the CEO of Google. Like, it's a big deal that they were there. They're all trying to do their best, kiss up to Trump. But, you know, there are reasons that it's hard to settle these suits. Notably, that the federal government has brought these suits, but they often do it with co-plaintiffs, the state level. And so, you know, the federal government can drop lawsuits if they want to, or they can settle them, but they have to convince the state attorneys general, who are often elected and often Democrats, to go along. And that, I think, could be not so easy. I also think there might be reasons why the Trump administration, they might be doing favors for these companies in other areas and not necessarily dropping the antitrust cases. But yeah, I mean, you're right. There are reasons to think that they're gonna roll back some of this stuff.
So that's the playing field for monopolization. Let's get back to RealPage, since aside, as I say, from eggs, rent inflation would arguably be the most salient form of inflation that's affected most people in the last few years. Well, you ran some numbers on how RealPage affects rents in various places. Give us the general idea of what you found.
Yeah, so I did some numbers and I looked, it's not clear exactly how much it affected the rent in America in general, because it is very city specific. Like if you live in Las Vegas, you know, I guess it's possible that your rent is vaguely in some way affected by the rent in Miami, just because maybe people in Miami it's too expensive to leave and go to Las Vegas. But really it's a regional thing, right? So there's no national market for rent. But RealPage clients do have a big presence in cities that live in about 100 million people live there. This is, you know, Anaheim, Atlanta, Austin, Baltimore, Dallas, Colorado Springs, Houston, Kansas City, Las Vegas, Portland, Phoenix, Tucson, et cetera, Washington, D.C. Mm. And, you know, what I found is that there was a substantial increase in housing inflation during the COVID and post-COVID era. And that was really important in 2024. About 70% of all inflation came from the cost of shelter, mm-hmm. right? So inflation was high. I think most people are like, man, food is really expensive. And that was a big mm-hmm. part of it. Food, because economists are bad, is often excluded from the way that we think about inflation, which is ridiculous, food and energy. But you know, just of the normal inflation gouge, it for a period of time, it was largely about just almost entirely about shelter. Mm. And shelter is divided into people who buy homes, mm-hmm. which is really driven by price of houses, but also interest rates. And those went really, really high over the, so prices went way up. It's not totally clear how much rent went up because there are different indices, but you could say rent went up about 20% to a third in from 2001 to 2022 across the country. And, you know, and that's an average. So in some cities it went up way more, in other cities it didn't really go up that much. The extra rent hike in the cities where real page landlords have market power, the extra rent hike was between, at the high end, about a quarter of rental inflation could be due to this alleged conspiracy. Now, that's not a quarter of rent. That's a quarter of the increase in rent.
Right.
And then at a low end, it could be about, you know, it's probably like 1 to 5% of all rental inflation, and that's nationwide. And if you're talking about the cities themselves, it could be more than that. So it's not a small amount of money. It's definitely not all rental inflation. Like, there was a and still is a housing shortage, but it is accelerated by the use of these algorithms. And you also have something called the umbrella effect. So it's not just the landlords, the corporate landlords, that are making more money. It's like, if they hold supply off the market, even if you're not part of the conspiracy, the like normal rent levels are still higher than they would ordinarily be. And so if you're a landlord, you're going to be charging more than you otherwise would. And you're a renter, you're going to be paying more than you otherwise would. It's a little bit like when two wireless companies merged, like Sprint and T-Mobile, they merged and prices have, you know, had been going down. They stopped going down. Now they're going up a little bit. You know, certainly Sprint and T-Mobile benefited from that, but AT&T and Verizon did as well, because they don't have to cut prices to keep share. They could raise prices a little bit. So people that are not parties to the conspiracy, or corporations that are not parties to the conspiracy, can still benefit from it. So that's what, you know, that's what's largely going on. And there's also a debate in overhousing right now. And a lot of people are what's called YIMBYs, or yes in my backyard. And they argue that there are restrictions on housing supply, artificial restrictions, like, you know, you can only build single family homes here, or you can't build at all. And that's very limiting, because in some areas you'd want to build denser development to allow more people to live there, and that creates artificial supply constraints. And they're right about that. But the other part of it is that the big landlords, they don't want more supply. They like to control supply so they can control pricing.
So you mentioned that there was a legal action in place, or an action already, against RealPage. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, so there's a series of antitrust cases. There's an antitrust case from the Attorney General of Arizona, and then there's I believe there's another antitrust case. I forgot, another state attorney general. They brought their own case, and then there was an antitrust case from the federal government, along with a series of states. And that case is against both RealPage, but also, I believe, 7 or 6 corporate landlords. One of them, Cortland, is not. I mean, it was named in the complaint, but they started giving, I think they gave evidence, so they're not, you know, one of the targets. But I'm not totally sure about that, the details. But that's what's going on. And, you know, then there's this legislation as well. And I think a lot of landlords now are scared to use the pricing recommendation engine for RealPage now. So it's, even though the case is going to take a long time, the legislation isn't passed everywhere yet. If you're a big landlord, right, your lawyer is going to tell you, stop doing this, right? And so that's what is starting to happen, is some of these people are just being like, I will use this software to manage my inventory, but I'm not going to use the recommendation engine anymore. I lived in one of these. Corporate landlord buildings. It was very nice. I liked it, but we had this very weird experience where I was in a I was in an apartment, and I looked online, and there was the same apartment, the same layout on a different floor in the building that was available for less than the one I had, and our rent was coming due, or our lease was coming up. So I went to the building manager and I said, hey, can we have the same price since you're putting that one on the market? And she was like, oh yeah, let me look into that. And she came back, she's like, no, you can't. You have to move to that apartment if you want it. It was like a pain, right, to move, even though it's the same apartment. And so she's like, it's really weird. They won't let me do it. And so like we went back and forth and talked about it a while, and I looked in other buildings. I was like, look, if you don't let us do it, we're gonna go to this a different building, or we might just go and rent your own apartment that you have available. And she was like, fine. And she worked at it. Finally, we were able to get our rent reduced, so we didn't have to move, which would have been a big pain.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I don't know why they wouldn't let me do this. And it turns out, we learned in these cases, that RealPage works with these companies, and these are big companies. They're not, it's not like they own a couple of buildings, right? This woman was just an employee, and RealPage has a deal with their clients where they say, if your employees try to negotiate with tenants and lower rents, we will have consultants harass them.
Wow.
And we will basically go to you and snitch on them, and you've got to stop them from doing it, or else we might fire you as a client. Right. So it's not like these guys are not just like making recommendations. Like, there is an active conspiracy here, or at least that was the allegation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why this woman, who was great and really enjoyed, really enjoyed her working with her on living in the building. She was always lovely and very competent, but she was just like, this is very weird. They won't let me do this. So it's a lot of stuff like that. It's not just like, lower, lower rent prices. It's also like weird things that are going on that really inflexible centralization that takes place in these kinds of situations.
So the cases are going through court, and we have an administration now, which arguably, as we were talking about the big guys at the inauguration, might not be as prone to pursue the federal case against RealPage, or do you think that's mistaken?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see, right? There is, it's not like the CEO, RealPage is owned by a private equity firm, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I guess these landlords probably have, these are often owned by billionaires. Mm-hmm. So they probably do have leverage with Trump. They might know him.
Mm.
I don't know. But you have co-plaintiffs, and I think rent, look, your guess is as good as mine as to what Trump is going to do. But, his antitrust chief, she's generally considered an enforcement-minded official. So it's not all necessarily bad news. But I want to just give you, because I didn't give you clean numbers before, I just want to tell you where I got the number. Like, I did a bunch of calculations, and they were sort of back of the envelope. There have been other people who have done calculations and found different numbers. Everybody agrees there's been a non-trivial increase in rent. But RealPage itself said that its service was designed to offer a, quote, revenue lift between 3-7% year over year. And that's even in downturns.
Mm.
So if you think about that, right? If you start using RealPage, and it's a marketing, that was marketing, right? So maybe maybe they're overstating it, or maybe they're not. But it's like, that's over time, that is a pretty significant amount of money. It's a pretty significant increase in rent. If you have a non-trivial chunk of the market, you're start in, RealPage takes over in certain cities like Atlanta in 2016, 2024, 2025, that's not, I only did my calculation from 2021 onward, but it's like, there are reasons to think that this is pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, and let me now give I sort of went through these calculations, and so you're getting into my thought processes here, so apologize for that. But, you might wonder, I think this is where the YIMBY people have a point, which is, all right, if the rents are going up so high, you would expect people to say, oh, I can make money if I build, buildings and start renting stuff out.
In an ordinary market, you would, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a lot of building in 2022 and 2023, but less, and then so a bunch of stuff came on the market in 2024. But One of the problems is that our banking system has gotten super consolidated. And so a lot of the banks that used to do big construction loans just aren't there anymore. So you have a whole mid-tier of financing that is just gone. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the builders are gone as well. So the building market is pretty bad. And then you have, you know, a lot of the restrictions on building in dense area. That's where I think I agree with the YIMBY people. But you have, like, this is sort of if you look at America and the American system and you're like, all right, it's not working. We're seeing shortages in everything from, like, baby formula to black pipe during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. These are usually, you know, there's a number of systems that are malfunctioning. And that's what's going on.
But going back to RealPage to just wrap this up, that basically is just like a privately assessed tax, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it isn't actually just a tax because they're also holding supply off the market.
Right, right. So it's a two-pronged attack.
Yeah, that's right. And innovation, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons you're seeing Chinese tech companies doing better than American tech companies is just our companies are monopolistic and don't have the spur to innovate anymore.
You mean we're more monopolistic than the Chinese?
Oh, yeah, no question.
Wow.
And not in everything.
No, I know.
But in certain areas. But yeah.
Wow. The name of your newsletter is Big, and it covers the world of monopolies, right?
That's right.
And people can subscribe to it if they want to follow this stuff. I think it's fascinating. And much of it, as I said, doesn't get covered by the rest of the media. So I really appreciate the time you spent with us today, Matt.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That's it for this week's edition of the show. Back next week, same time, over these same radio stations or on your audio device of choice. The tip of the show, chapeau to Pam Halstead, Thomas Walsh, and the San Diego Desk. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. Happy Mardi Gras, everybody. So long from the Crescent City.